Welcome to the LACNETS podcast. I'm your host, Lisa Yen. I'm the LACNETS Director of Programs and Outreach, as well as a caregiver and advocate for my husband who is living with NET. In each podcast episode, we talk to a NET expert who answers your top 10 questions. This podcast is for educational purposes only and does not constitute medical advice. Please discuss your questions and concerns with your physician.
Welcome to the LACNETS podcast. I'm really excited to introduce today Dr. Scott Paulson, a medical oncologist and the medical director for the Neuroendocrine Research and Treatment Center at Baylor in Dallas, Texas. He serves as the co-director of the Gastrointestinal Research Program for the Sarah Cannon Research Institute. Dr. Paulson earned his medical doctorate at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical School. He did his residency and internship in internal medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, Massachusetts, and his fellowship in medical oncology at the University of California, San Francisco in San Francisco, California. Dr. Paulson is active in clinical research focused on neuroendocrine tumors, as well as cancers of the pancreas, liver, esophagus, stomach, and colon. And he currently has a clinical trial open studying bavdegalutamide, an mTOR inhibitor, which is a type of targeted therapy. And because of his research in this area, I asked Dr. Paulson to join us to discuss targeted therapy for NET. I just want to share a fun fact about Dr. Paulson. He hates wine kitsch, but he loves coffee kitsch. So say a little bit more about that, and then also share how you got into neuroendocrine tumors.
Those are two different directions, right? Hate's a strong word. I just don't find it funny. I think if you've got a hand towel that says it's wine o'clock, I'm not going to laugh. But anytime I've got a coffee cup that says no coffee, no worky, I think that's hysterical. And it's just personal preference. There's nothing specific that brought me to that point. It's just the way it is. Can't explain it.
There's something real about no coffee, no worky.
The phrase makes me laugh. I don't know why.
It's hilarious. So how did you get involved in neuroendocrine tumors?
Then I think this is not very different from anybody in medicine. I think a lot of it really depends on mentors and who you look up to and who you end up working with when you're training. When I first went into residency, I started out, I want to be an orthopedic surgeon. So I went to the cardiac cath lab and I was going to be an interventional cardiologist. Then during medicine residency, started working with a bunch of oncologists and really liked who I was working with, started doing some research work with them. And then when I got to UCSF, started working a lot with Emily Bergsland, and I just found neuroendocrine tumors fascinating. I still do. I think they're just, from the pure biology standpoint, really interesting. Patients with neuroendocrine tumors are just, for lack of a better way to say it, infinitely lovable. I don't know. There's something about the personality that's associated with it. So you get into that, and that's where you go. I was a gastrointestinal medical oncologist, so I trained in everything GI. And when I got to Dallas, there wasn't really anybody who was focused on neuroendocrine tumors, and echoing in my head from my mentor, Emily, look at where you're at and do what you can succeed with. So we started building out programs here, some research programs with neuroendocrine tumors, started doing some studies and built out a PRRT program, the first of its kind in North Texas. And well, here we are.
Well, we're really glad that you have met some of those people that have made such an impact, like Dr. Bergsland, and that you're doing the work you're doing in a much needed area. Thank you for doing that.
I've enjoyed it. There's no question. We've learned a lot. It's changed a lot over the years.
So much has changed. And I know you and I have met at these collaborative summits through the Healing Net Foundation. I've been impressed by your insights, some of the things that you've shared and how you share it. So I look forward to this conversation about targeted therapies.
Sounds good. We like targeted therapy.
Okay, let's jump into the first question. What are targeted therapies? Why are they even called that? And are they considered chemotherapy?
You know, I've been prepping for that question because I knew it was coming, right? What is a targeted therapy? And really, you can make an argument that any drug is a targeted therapy, right? That a drug somehow interferes with a normal process going on in your body. And depending on how you define a targeted therapy, you really could say that anything is, because it has something that it disrupts within the body. But when we talk about it in the context of cancer, which is almost exclusively where that term's used, we tend to think about it in the concept of chemotherapy, targeted therapies, and immune therapies. And chemotherapies are the classic treatment for cancers and have been around since well before the disco era. And the term, when I say it and when I'm talking with patients, I say I'm talking about a poison that kills things that grow. It's basically what they are. It's not really specific to what's growing. The chemotherapies still have a target. Oftentimes that's, for instance, destroying something along DNA that causes a cell not to be able to grow very well, or interfering with a protein product that helps build a copy of a cancer cell. But at the heart of it, it's not very specific to any other biologic process other than growth. So chemotherapy, we're talking about something that kills growing things. Targeted therapy, when you say we're targeting a very specific biologic process, you're trying to be a little bit more fine-tuned. So selecting something that's a property of cancer cells that allows them to grow at an inappropriate rate, because that's really the heart of what a cancer is something that's growing inappropriately or in a way that isn't structured. And so you're taking a drug that's interfering with whatever that process is. It's not necessarily going to poison anything and everything that's growing, but it may be interfering with something that cancers use to try to increase their size and their processes. And so that could either be horribly more confusing, or it could be enlightening on how you think about those two different processes of drugs. But targeted therapy, we're trying to take something that's wrong with the cancer and then attack it much more specifically outside of just the fact that they grow.
That's helpful. So a different bucket. So the chemotherapy kills the growing things, and then the target therapy is more like stopping it from even growing.
Yes. If you think about things like PRRT, which I think most folks who are on any net website have come across PRRT, peptide receptor radionuclide therapy, you're talking about peptide receptors. You're talking about a form of targeted therapy one way or another. There's a target that you're sticking things to, but ultimately what does the killing is radioactivity. So that's what's actually taking out cells. That's why we don't necessarily lump that into targeted therapy. With a lot of targeted therapies, and not too different from a lot of NETs, there's a light switch that's flipped on and a cancer cell somewhere that's driving a process. And we're just trying to flip that switch off.
Flipping the switch off. So keeping it from growing before it even does.
Correct.
So for neuroendocrine tumors, neuroendocrine cancers, what are the targeted therapies that you do consider?
Yeah, so it depends a little bit on where the neuroendocrine tumor started. Some targeted therapies are more effective in different types of neuroendocrine tumor. I would argue the most established one would be a drug like everolimus or afinitor. Everolimus targets a protein in the cancer cell called mTOR, M-T-O-R, and has a fairly broad activity, meaning there's clinical trials that have shown that it slows the growth of neuroendocrine tumors in multiple different types of neuroendocrine tumor, lung, GI, and pancreas. So mTOR is this little protein that kind of sits down towards the middle of a cancer cell. And when it's active and actively sending signals through the cancer cell, it's trying to tell that cell to grow, but also increase some growth processes with it. So this tends to interfere with that and try to turn it off. Neuroendocrine tumors tend to be a little bit more dependent on that protein than other types of cancers, which is why we tend to use it. There's some things about mTOR that have frustrated many, including yours truly, in that we don't really have a great biomarker that tells us when it's going to work. Even though we're trying to target a very specific thing, sometimes it works when we test a cancer and we don't see that mTOR is really ramped up or overactive, and sometimes it works when it's not. And so that's been one of the things that I think is a little frustrating about that one. Another form or class of targeted therapy would be things that disrupt a pathway in cancer cells called vascular endothelial growth factor, or VEGF, V-E-G-F. The most established one of this is sunitinib, or Sutent. A study that was done back in 2011 that showed that on average, Sutent kept pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors from growing for about a year. About 5-10% of the time caused some major shrinkage of them. It's a drug that tends to slow down the growth of tumors by interfering with a biologic process that's important in how tumors build blood supply and also how they kind of respond to some growth signals. So Sutent or sunitinib would be another targeted therapy that really only has a lot of evidence for its use in pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors. Other drugs targeting this VEGF pathway have certainly been explored, including a drug called bevacizumab, as well as a variety of other drugs such as pazopanib. And their results have been a little bit mixed of whether or not they really help that much. Certainly outside of the pancreas, we're not really sure that they help a ton, although there's times where we'll consider it. But that would be another example of a targeted therapy that has an approved indication here. I'll at least talk for a brief moment about surufatinib, which is an interesting drug. Surufatinib was another drug somewhat in this class with sunitinib. It really affected this VEGF pathway, and it showed significant activity in neuroendocrine tumors in large studies performed in China where the drug is used and available. And It replicated those results in a U.S. population, but because there's not a lot of data in the United States population, it's not currently approved for that indication. Would be another example of how we think targeting these pathways actually does have an effect on slowing the growth of neuroendocrine tumors. Building on that, cabozantinib, which just recently released data in a study called the CABINET trial back in October 2023, demonstrated activity in both extrapancreatic neuroendocrine tumors and pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors. As we tend to see with these targeted therapies, tends to be a little bit more of a difference in activity in the pancreatic neuroendocrine tumor subset. That's not really what the study was trying to look like. But again, we tend to see targeted therapy having more of a sequential role in pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors than clearly established in extrapancreatic neuroendocrine tumors. I'm not saying you should draw that conclusion from the CABINET study, but you take that with drugs like sunitinib and even some of the other targeted therapies that have been trialed. We tend to see orders of magnitude more effect in pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors. Cabozantinib is not a drug that just targets that VEGF. It hits a couple of other receptors. You'll hear us use a lot of euphemisms from time to time. A lot of targeted therapies are what we call tyrosine kinase inhibitors or TKIs. And so we'll throw around the term TKI. And all that's referring to is how a drug blocks a protein's effect. Proteins are these little things running around cancer cells that tell something to do something else. And when you've got a tyrosine kinase inhibitor, it's talking about how it blocks that protein or how it interferes with the effect of that protein. So you'll hear the term TKI a lot, and that's referring to a lot of our targeted therapies. They tend to be TKIs. And then you'll hear the term dirty TKI from time to time, meaning that it interferes with a lot of different protein cellular processes. And then cabozantinib, I wouldn't necessarily quantify as a dirty TKI, but it does hit a couple of different protein targets, all of which tend to interfere with growth processes that the cancer cells are commonly trying to use. So that's cabozantinib. We're expecting that this will be reviewed by regulatory agencies and likely be another tool in the tool belt, if you will, sometime 2024.
Thank you for giving us a really thorough overview of this class. So if I understand this correctly, under this bigger bucket of the targeted therapies, there's two classes. There's one that targets the mTOR inhibitors, like the everolimus afinitor, which is currently FDA approved. And then there's the other bucket of TKIs or ones that disrupt the VEGR protein. And that includes the sunitinib or Sutent. And then some other ones that have been under investigation, surufatinib, cabozantinib, hopefully some other tools in the tool belt. Am I understanding this correctly?
Correct. Those are the two big buckets of targeted therapies that are applicable for neuroendocrine tumor. In other types of cancer, there's 300 plus. But for what we think is important for neuroendocrine tumor biology, as we understand it, those are the two important things to know.
And thank you for highlighting. They're not just used for neuroendocrine tumor. They're used for other cancers too.
Absolutely. So everolimus, for instance, has a breast indication and an indication in some other areas. mTOR inhibitors are actually a class of drugs that are used for patients with things like renal transplants. So people who have had a kidney transplant to help modulate the immune system in a way that allows that transplant to sit in somebody else's body. So these drugs have other uses for them for sure. Sunitinib first made its way onto the scene as a kidney cancer drug, where nothing had ever really worked for kidney cancer. They were highly chemotherapy resistant. Sunitinib was really the first medication in kidney cancer that actually demonstrated a clear benefit. So they're not just applicable to neuroendocrine tumors. I think that's an important point to celebrate here. It's a point of frustration of mine. I don't know if others call it out as much as I tend to do. When we're using targeted therapies in neuroendocrine tumors, we're not really linking it to a biomarker. Okay, so you mentioned the two specific classes that we use, and they're general targeted therapies. They just kind of tie up typical cancer machinery. What we really want to get to with targeted therapy, what the dream and the hope is that we find what is the actual molecular switch, what's the real disorder with what makes a tumor cell behave inappropriately, and then go after that. And right now, we do not have a biomarker that ties us to the use of these drugs. Biomarker meaning something we can take out a piece of the cancer, send it off to the really, really smart people in the molecular pathology lab, and they can come back to us in 2 weeks and tell us, hey, there's a mutation in this tumor that's causing it to grow inappropriately, and then we can link it to a drug. There's times we find that in neuroendocrine tumors, but it's very, very, very rare. Most of the time we're using these drugs, for lack of a better way to say it, non-selectively.
Okay, so if we don't have a biomarker and we know you're interested in using this drug, when do you use them and how do you use them?
Varies for everybody. Depends on the goals. You know, you asked me kind of what I really liked about neuroendocrine tumors from the start. Everybody is and should be treated as an individual with neuroendocrine tumors. There's such a heterogeneity. That doesn't make it easy for patients. I think it makes it really, really hard for patients. When somebody first walks into my office, first thing I'm going to sit down and look at is how much tumor do we have? And most of the time we find these, they've metastasized. I usually will tell folks, most of the time we see them, they're stage four. But stage doesn't matter to us as much as it does for other types of cancers. And so usually, if you're not that familiar with cancer, you hear the term stage and you hear stage four and say, I'm at the final stage. And oh my goodness, that's not at all the case with neuroendocrine tumors. Stage doesn't matter that much prognostically. What I'm really looking for with stage four tumor is how much cancer is there? Is it a large bulk of disease? Where is it located? What happens if it grows? How much does it have to grow to cause big problems? The second thing I'm looking at is where did it start? Because that does give us some clues to the biology of it and how things will respond to things like targeted therapies. We talked about the differences between pancreatic and non-pancreatic. The third thing I'm asking is what kind of symptoms does somebody have? Is a patient symptomatic because their tumor is making a ton of hormone that may cause me to treat somebody differently than if the only reason that we found this is because somebody stumbled and fell in a CT scanner and we found a tumor in the liver? If you're asymptomatic, that provides us an awful lot of treatment flexibility. So if those are the first couple of things that I'm asking. In general, if somebody's got a relatively low symptom burden and a relatively low burden of disease, we're usually going to just start with somatostatin analog therapy. So lanreotide, octreotide, LAR being the two approved in the United States. Targeted therapies, I'm generally thinking about utilizing somewhere midway through the treatment algorithm for somebody with neuroendocrine tumors. And I'm usually thinking about what we know that they do. It's important to know that you can't just do what we call cross-trial comparisons, but we're going to take all of these trials with targeted therapies and we're going to look at the results and get a general idea of what they can do for me as a physician, which is, on average, they can stop tumors from growing for a reasonable time period, anywhere from 8 to 14 months, depending on the study you're looking at. There's a lot of flexibility on each side of that. But what I tell patients is, on average, what these things tend to do is stop tumors from growing for about a year. And within that, that doesn't mean they stop everybody's tumor from growing. Some grow right through it like we're not giving you anything. Again, I said, we don't have a biomarker, so we don't have the correlative science to predict when that's going to happen. Some tumors actually shrink when we give these. Then about 5 to 15% of individuals, when we give these drugs, we are going to see some significant shrinkage of tumor. And when that happens, it's great. We don't know why it happens, but occasionally we get some really good effect. And for the most part, for the vast majority of individuals, it's going to stop tumors from growing for a little while at the expense of some side effects. And because of that, we're not apt to use it right up front. They have a higher side effect profile than what you would expect from lanreotide or octreotide. Some folks take to them like a duck to water. They feel great on them in many ways, especially if they're actually one of that lower percentage that gets a really significant response. They feel a lot better. But for the most part, these have a fair amount of irritating, continuous side effects that can range from the mildly annoying to, frankly, in rare cases, the life-threatening. When we're using these, we're using it to say, well, if I've got a bulk of disease that if it grows, I'm not going to be in a good position here, so I need to stop some growth. Or if we're looking to try to move over to something else and see if we can get away without a lot of side effects where we can also prevent growth. But we're usually not starting these and expecting tumors to melt.
Okay, really good point. So the goal of the treatment is to stop the progression or growth of the tumors rather than shrinkage. And I'm glad you brought up side effects. This is a big concern, as you know, for people who are going to be taking the drug. So what are the common side effects? What do they need to be aware of?
I'll start with mTOR inhibitors first. You mentioned nab-sirolimus, currently ongoing trial. The purpose of it is really trying to reduce side effects while increasing potency. Suffice it to say, there's interest in trying to create better ways of targeting the mTOR pathway. Everolimus, which is our approved drug, it's a pill. It's taken daily. And the biggest side effect that almost everybody at least notices a little bit of is mouth sores. And that can run the gamut from just a little bit of a cottony mouth feeling that doesn't disrupt anything to really being bad enough where people can't swallow. That's obviously a big deal. You have to be able to eat. We give folks a dexamethasone mouthwash, so a steroid mouthwash, to try to prevent that. And it's pretty good at reducing it, but usually you can expect to have a little bit of mouth sores. Sometimes it can give them a little bit of GI toxicity, and it does tend to mess with people's blood sugars. Sometimes it'll make blood sugars actually go down a little bit weirdly, but a lot of times it makes them go up a little bit. And this is pretty important if you have pre-existing diabetes or any conditions that are concerning for tipping you over into having high blood sugars. Everolimus can certainly potentiate that. It does tend to suppress the immune system. It does tend to suppress the immune system a little bit in weird ways. We classically think of chemotherapy as being the bigger immunosuppression risks, but everolimus tends to alter viral immunity in ways that can be substantial. I think more on reactivation of shingles, exposure to viruses that may, for lack of a better way to say, hit you a little bit harder. Less commonly, it can actually reduce your blood counts. It's not that terribly common in this class of drugs, but it can. That's kind of more of a typical chemotherapy side effect. The other thing that's always growing in your body is your blood. You're always making a whole new set of blood, because remember, we've said chemotherapies are poisons that kill things that grow. They're going to hit your blood counts. Targeted therapies don't always, but everolimus does tend to reduce blood counts a little bit. And sometimes that's enough where it can put you at risk for having things like anemia and low platelets, which help you clot blood. So we could theoretically worry about running into problems with bleeding and other odd types of infection, but we really just don't tend to see that much with everolimus. The other thing it can do is it can cause a kind of a weird inflammatory process in the lung. That's rare, but it's serious when it happens. We're pretty good about looking for that, so usually we're going to pick that up at the stage that it's just a cough, and it does tend to get better when you stop the drug, but it's one of the things that we're always attending to. It has some drug interactions. These can be potentially life-threatening, and I think they're fairly poorly explained, frankly. So I always just say it doesn't get the moniker chemotherapy, which I think strikes fear into everybody's heart, but make no mistake, this stuff can make you feel bad, and it can actually be fairly severe in its effects. So much so that you could potentially have life-threatening side effects. I'm not trying to instill fear. I will say that 95% of folks who take everolimus have a host of irritating side effects, oftentimes that require some dose adjustments, and are able to take the drug and derive some degree of benefit from it. But make no mistake, even though it's not chemotherapy, this stuff can hurt you.
Wow. It's like you read my mind. Those were many of my questions. Does it cause diabetes? Does it cause people to be immunocompromised? Does it affect one's blood count? So why would anyone want to be on all these if the side effects are so harsh?
Every time we put somebody on a new drug who's got a neuroendocrine tumor, I'm trying to think, what am I going to get out of it? There's a couple of challenges that we need to point out with neuroendocrine tumor drug development, which, just saying it flat out, was not always exactly on the radar of pharmaceutical companies. It's not a common disease. Pharmaceutical companies are businesses. It is the way that it is. And it's really difficult to show that taking a drug can clearly make somebody live longer with a neuroendocrine tumor. And this is a very good thing, because people with neuroendocrine tumors tend to live a long time. And the reason that's challenging is to do that research and actually do those trials and clearly show the benefit. You have a tough time doing really long studies that get really expensive, and a lot of weird things that you can't control happen in between. So what's changed a lot is trying to come up with endpoints that make us think that taking these drugs sequentially over time helps people live longer. And so when we're doing clinical trials, we look at it and say, if we can keep a tumor from growing for a year, whereas we know a placebo in the same situation only stops a tumor from growing for about 3 to 4 months, that's been shown again and again, then we think that that drug can help people live longer with the tumor. So the first thing is we think that it can help people live longer. The second thing is that we think that if you dose modulate it and you're effectively paying attention to how people feel on it, that you can still likely derive these benefits, but making sure you get down to the right dose. And I run into this anxiety a lot from patients, like, well, I feel miserable all the time, but it's not that bad. It's like, no, that's bad. That means we need to take the doses of these drugs down. I'll get off on a brief stump speech tangent that's probably right up there with my coffee wine kitsch issue, but targeted therapies were designed, the way they were brought to the clinic is the same way we brought chemotherapies to the clinic, which is you take three folks with a drug, you give them a high dose of the drug. If it really hurts somebody badly, 1 out of 3, then you've gone too high and you stop. Your goal is to get to a toxicity level that is as high as you possibly can get without causing serious harm to more than 1 out of 3 individuals. That doesn't really fly in the neuroendocrine tumor world. We're not trying to kill every tumor cell. When you go through surgery with neuroendocrine tumors, I don't need a surgeon to get every single tumor cell out. We need to take things out in a way that's practical and helps people feel better. So targeted therapies were brought along the same way, which is we're going to push the dose to a maximum tolerated dose, and we're going to get to as high a dose as we possibly can until somebody gets really, really sick. And then we're going to try to move that forward and see if it's effective in treating tumors. And so consequently, we have these doses of drugs that are probably too high. Can I prove that to you? No, because not a lot of people have gone back and done the back-end studies on it. But what I'm getting at is a lot of times, as long as we ratchet down the dose appropriately, we can usually find a way to get to something that's acceptable. Can it hurt you? Yeah, absolutely can. But we think that slowing the growth of tumor over time, preventing tumor growth in strategic locations, provides an opportunity for individuals to live longer with the disease. That's the main reason that we proceed with targeted therapy.
Thank you for that overview and the insight about the purpose of the therapy and how it's different from other cancers, not trying to kill every cell.
It's a very different approach that we have with neuroendocrine tumors, where a lot of times we're trying to think about coexistence rather than elimination. Trying to get rid of every single neuroendocrine tumor cell is oftentimes a way to cause significant harm and not necessarily affect somebody's overall survival. This is not the way it is for every cancer patient, but for the most part, I have found there's 2 things that are really important. How long am I going to live with this thing if I can't get rid of it? And how am I going to feel when I'm living? And so trying to affect those balances are what we're trying to do with targeted therapy.
That is really helpful. So it's a different approach. It might be a message that's hard to swallow, especially those who are new to this. The idea of living with cancer cells is different from other cancer therapy approaches where you're trying to get rid of every cell. So how do you counsel patients? How do you help them wrap their head around this idea that I can live with cancer cells within me and the goal is not to kill every single cell?
Have you ever read the Harry Potter books?
Of course.
Most people have, right? All right. So the invisibility cloak that Harry Potter has, right? Talking about how basically you hide from death for as long as you possibly can until you grow older with it, as opposed to using the wand of power. That's kind of generally the analogy. I honestly use this with patients that I know very well, obviously. But we talk about using something that allows you an ability to coexist with something that can be a very mortal disease versus trying to attack it full force. In neuroendocrine tumors, and this is not a one size fits all, but a lot of times if you can figure out a way to coexist meaningfully with the disease in a way where your quality of life is preserved and you do not go through procedures that cause undue and significant and severe harm, then that can provide optimal quality of life, but also duration. And in trying to absolutely rid yourself of every piece of the disease, sometimes you can cause harm, sometimes you can live less time, and sometimes you can suffer undue consequences. That whole balance is a struggle for both doctor and patient, because what we try to do, we try to listen to a patient's desires. This may be different if you're 35 and you have 2 young kids, and it may be different if you're 65 and you really want to enjoy retirement that just happened 6 months ago. So your goals may be totally different, whether or not you want to live and coexist with the disease versus try to take it head on and be aggressive with it. But that's an idea that I think is extremely difficult, because what everybody really wants is to be able to walk out of a cancer clinic and say it's gone and it's never coming back. And as challenging as it is for me to say it to folks, I usually think I do better favors if I say, hey, look, this is something we're going to be coexisting with for a long period of time. And my goal is to make that time as long as possible. So when we look at targeted therapies and we say, hey, at most, maybe we get to double digit percentages times where tumors shrink a lot, or we get into some form of remission, but we do at least slow down the growth of tumor, then it's a tool. It's a card to play. It's not the best card. And sometimes it's a card that injures, frankly. So it's not like it's an absolute win. It's not the ace of spades, but we do occasionally provide some benefit to folks. So that's kind of how I think about targeted therapy, is really adjusting to the idea of coexistence.
That's actually helpful to really understand the goals, right?
If you recall, Harry Potter, the invisibility cloak wizard was the one that lived the longest, right? Versus the wand of power person was taken out by the wand itself. I'm not very good on my Harry Potter lore. I have to go back, but I think that was the point of that story.
Yeah.
So that's the issue here. It's a little bit tricky because targeted therapies can hurt people. We move on to VEGF-directed therapies and sunitinib. These are not harm-free medications. Sunitinib tends to cause more blood count lowering. It can cause a little bit more of hand-foot irritation, so the swelling of the hand and feet. Cabozantinib tends to do that a little bit more too, where you can get blisterings on your fingertips and toes. It causes a lot more just general GI, non-specific, not really nausea. It's not always really diarrhea. It depends on who you ask, but it just kind of throws the GI tract into a lot of disarray. Does some weird stuff to how it changes the color of your hair. And then it tends to make people just flat out tired. It'll mess with blood pressure. It can mess with things like blood clotting and bleeding issues. So if you have a lot of wound healing problems or bleeding disorders, we tend to worry about it. It's like everolimus, which is a totally different class of drugs. It's extremely rare where I don't have to put somebody on a much lower than recommended dose. Does it have its occasional use? Yeah, and I've been doing this long enough to have seen those individuals who have significant shrinkage on these drugs. I wish I could pick them. I wish I had better science where I could say, I know you're going to have significant shrinkage on it, and therefore this is a great drug. But in reality, folks at some point along their neuroendocrine journey tend to end up exposed to these types of classes of drug. And sometimes it really helps. Sometimes it seems to do nothing at all. Sometimes it causes a lot of toxicity that we can't manage with good dose reductions and management. And sometimes it just keeps things from growing at a reasonable, tolerable level of toxicity where you can stay on it for a prolonged period of time.
So it's helpful to have these tools in the toolbox. And you mentioned several of them in both the categories, the mTOR inhibitor with everolimus and then VEGF inhibitors. How do you choose which drug to suggest for a patient to take?
Usually what else they got going on medically, you know, if somebody's got things like major cardiac problems or problems with a history of blood clot or reasons to have wound healing concerns, I'm not going to select VEGF therapies first. Folks who are a lot older and have atherosclerotic disease, so calcium plaques in the arteries, are going to be a little bit higher risk for problems with VEGF inhibitors. And we worry about things like blood clots. So I'm not going to go that direction. And if you've got blood sugar problems or major pancreatic function problems, then I may put mTOR inhibitors back in my back pocket and use those a little bit more sparingly. So usually it's going to depend on what you have going on. Also, of course, it depends on whether you got your pancreatic neuroendocrine tumor or not. We at least have evidence that everolimus has a reasonably controlled effect on neuroendocrine tumors from outside of the pancreas as well. So there's been more studies that have been done on that. So it has to do with where your tumor started and what other side effects you can have and what side effects we want to avoid.
You mentioned pancreas, you mentioned outside the pancreas, and you mentioned before that word extra pancreas. So can you actually define what extra pancreas means and whether or not these drugs can be used even for lung mets?
Neuroendocrine tumors, they're tumors that come from pretty much anywhere in the body. Usually tell folks from the neck to the rectum and everywhere in between. And pancreatic neuroendocrine tumor biology just tends to be a little bit of its own beast. And so we tend to lump a lot of things into extrapancreatic neuroendocrine tumors. But that's most commonly lung, the tail end of the small intestine, colon and rectum. And those tend to be the primary spots that we're referring to with alternative neuroendocrine tumors. So really, we're thinking lung and intestinal type. That's going to make up the absolute bulk of extrapancreatic neuroendocrine tumors. But they can come from all kinds of weird places. The thymus, they can come from primary muscular regions where there's neuroendocrine cells. We think they can come from a couple of other areas, although the study on that's pretty minimal.
Thanks for clarifying. And if someone's taking one of these and then later on they need something else, can they take more than one drug in the category in their lifetime?
You can absolutely use these sequentially. And in reality, not necessarily what we're talking about at medical conferences or clinical trials, because the thing that I think is really difficult to get across to patients is that we make all of our treatment decisions based on clinical trials, and clinical trials have nothing to do with reality. They just don't. They're so carefully managed, but that's not really what happens and what patients have to deal with in real life. In reality, you can come on and off these therapies, start and stop. And occasional folks who have really good effect out of things like sunitinib and everolimus, you know, the tumor shrinkers, sometimes we'll be on it for a long period of time, get tired of the toxicities, need to move to other things, but we're not resistant to it, so we'll go back to it. You can come on and off of them. You can use these drugs sequentially. There's nothing that says that going on one therapy means you can't use it later. The only thing that says that is a clinical trial, which has extremely stringent rules about these things. But in actual real life, there's no real limits to how you approach that. As a physician, what we need to see is that we think it's benefiting keeping tumors in check in a way that is also improving quality of life.
Yeah, that's helpful to know the real life application. And actually, in that note, what's your approach with those things? You talked about the differences with those things and how a lot of times you have to go down. So how do you approach dosing?
This is well delineated. The FDA's got Project Optimus and all of these different things that are looking at saying we really need to take study sponsors, which in most of the world is almost always a pharmaceutical company, and really make sure that there's a development plan to not find the maximum tolerated dose, which is what's usually used in a cancer trial, taking as much of a potentially toxic drug as possible, as much as you can tolerate. Maximum tolerated dose is oftentimes too toxic, and we'd love to see a lot more optimization and dose optimization studies, but I'm optimistic that those are coming. I don't tend to start people at the full dose of either of these drugs, 37.5 milligrams of sunitinib or 10 milligrams of everolimus. I tend to start at a lower dose and tend to modulate it. Usually with everolimus, I'm going to start at 7.5 milligrams with a lot of folks. For people who are really young and fit, I'll just write their 10 milligrams and just say, look, we see you fairly frequently. We'll come down. So I usually tend to start at a lower dose and try to modulate from there. If somebody has zero side effects whatsoever and I've started at a lower dose, I will usually increase dose. All of this process could be criticized in an academic setting. We are flying by our experience on things. There is probably something to the dose does matter, and that you have to make sure you're hitting the target. You have to make sure however somebody's body is processing the drug, that you're actually getting the drug to tie up mTOR in the way that it's supposed to be doing, which, you know, you're usually going to see at least a little bit of sign clinically that that's happening. So if I were to start someone who says, I'm so scared of side effects, if I start somebody on 5 milligrams and it's a month later and they feel great, I'm probably going to say, you know, we probably ought to increase the dose of this a little bit until I can at least see some sort of effect. Unfortunately, with a lot of our cancer drugs, we're usually in the business of hurting some of your normal cells as well, because cancer used to be a part of you. If we start at a low dose and see absolutely no toxicity, I'm usually going to talk about increasing it a little bit. But if we're already seeing efficacy and zero side effects, we're going to stick with that. If you're seeing effects on tumor, then we're going to stick with the lowest possible dose. I usually start lower. A lot of my colleagues do. A lot of them do, and then say that they don't because there's no evidence for it, but they actually do. It's important to know that if you're having your dose of these drugs change, it's not like you failed somehow and that you're weak and you can't do it. It's much more that the system has failed you and how these drugs are dosed and designed. Keep that in mind. I see a lot of anxiety. Like, don't reduce it because I want the cancer to go away. You need to live your life and not feel miserable all the time.
Thank you for that permission and for clarifying what the real life experience is. And also, what is your approach with monitoring? What labs, what blood work or scans or anything absolutely need to be monitored while you're on these medications?
There's a podium answer which says that you need weekly labs and that you need weekly check-ins, usually with a nurse practitioner, to at least monitor a bunch of different things on a physical exam and everything else. And that's what I teach my fellows. What actually happens in real life is when we're using these drugs, one of the advantages is often they're oral and they're often shipped to your house. And we've got telemedicine now and you've got local laboratories. So a lot of the advantages of cancer therapies, in my mind, should be sparing you spending an entire day in a cancer center. I usually want to try to get labs every 2 to 3 weeks at a minimum for at least the first 6 to 8 weeks on both classes of drugs. Doesn't have to be fully weekly, but I usually want to make sure we're not affecting some sort of major laboratory parameter. We talked about blood sugar, rare instances of hepatotoxicity, so toxicity of the liver, these kinds of things. The blood count issue that I talked about, that we're not throwing these things into complete disarray. And as long as I'm getting that, I feel pretty comfortable checking in with folks from afar and trusting the people to not slip into unending misery and trying to monitor folks remotely. Because that's one of the great benefits of telemedicine in my mind with these oral drugs, is that we can try to keep people from having to come all the way in. I see a lot of folks from 4 or 5 hours away. When we're starting these drugs, if I can check in on you remotely and get some labs checked at your local LabCorp or Quest, it's a huge advantage in my mind. So I usually like to get those labs up front. We'll check tumor markers if they're helpful every 1 to 2 months or so. These are things your doc will occasionally check depending on your type of neuroendocrine tumor, like chromogranin, a whole host of different proteins and things that these tumors can make to try to get an idea, are we slowing down what this tumor is doing? So I usually get that after about 4 to 6 weeks to try to get a general feel. If I'm seeing an effect, I'd expect those to go down. I don't trust tumor markers fully. And then usually we'll get a follow-up imaging study in about 3 months, 2 months, if there's a real reason for it, meaning that I think that you've got tumor that really needs to be stopped from growing because it may cause a problem. It's pressing on an important vital function. But generally, a follow-up study every 3 months while you're on therapy. If you're having good effect, you have low toxicity, we figured out what the right dose is for you. Oftentimes, I'll get labs a lot less frequency, every couple of months, and scans sometimes even as infrequently as every 6 months. And the people who really take to these drugs well, that's not a huge number, but this is an oral drug. One of the advantages of not being in a clinic, getting an IV infusion on a regular basis, like so many cancer drugs, is to try to be able to divorce yourself from the cancer center if you can.
So thinking about quality of life and keeping that balance. And I'm wondering if taking any of these targeted therapies would preclude someone from getting another future treatment. A lot of people are interested in Lutathera, PRT, and especially in the alpha trials. Would taking any of these make someone not eligible?
Yeah, they can. And this is what's tricky. I think it's very hard for patients to try to take on navigating this themselves, because I can tell you as a physician, I can't take it on. The problem is you've got to make the right decision for you at the right time. You can't predict the future. And clinical trials, remember I already said, they're not real life, right? They have to be tightly controlled for a reason. There's so much bias that comes in from an oncologist. Remember, we want these drugs to work as much as you do. We're trying to take care of folks. We want them to work. So clinical trials have to be very tightly controlled so that we know that we're getting a true effect of a potentially toxic drug. But in doing so, they're written in a way that can be very exclusive. If you had everolimus, we don't want you on this alpha emitter trial because that's another line of therapy and we're only accepting two lines of therapy. So it's a very challenging thing for patients to navigate. My best advice is the following. Good drugs don't completely disappear. If you miss out on a trial, there's probably a reason that it will either come back around to you in some way, form, or fashion. It's rare with neuroendocrine tumors that we completely miss an opportunity. The tumor is often growing slow enough that we're savvy enough to help you try to get access to those things. So it's rare that we completely miss an opportunity. Targeted therapies can exclude you from some clinical trials depending on the number of lines of therapy. They can exclude you from some clinical trials. We mentioned the nab-sirolimus trial that I'm working on. It excludes people with prior everolimus, but look, that doesn't mean don't take everolimus. You know, nab-sirolimus is a drug that's given IV. It's given IV 2 out of 3 weeks. The goal of that trial is to find something that's better. We're looking for higher response rates. It may not have that. And it may be a huge inconvenience, in which case, if you've already taken everolimus, I don't want you to think that you've missed the cure for cancer. We don't know that. If it's a good drug, it's going to stick around. So I think it's very challenging to obsess about that. I struggle with it as well, but we really try to avoid so-called tailoring a treatment program for a patient so that they can steer into appropriate clinical trials. I do think some docs believe that's a good thing. I personally don't. I think you need to treat what's best for you at the right time. You may wake up tomorrow and find that alpha trial that you wanted to enroll on has been shut down because the drug is unsafe. It just may be. You may find out that it's been accelerated approval by the FDA because the effect of it is so wonderful and beneficial that it now needs to be disseminated immediately to the public, and therefore it won't really matter whether you're eligible for the trial or not. And I know that that's a really challenging thing to sit with because it's a real kind of nasty thing to hear, you're not eligible for this trial. It's like, you're not good enough for this trial. Well, it's just not the case. So best advice I can give is good drugs don't disappear. Do what's right for you at the time. Make decisions with the information you have at hand. The information may change tomorrow. You'll get different opinions on it, but those are my thoughts.
This is really helpful, really kind of overarching big picture advice that you're giving and really speaking to look at the present, eyes forward, look to the future, not backwards. So in that vein of looking forward, what is the latest in targeted therapy and what's the future of targeted therapies?
I think that we really haven't done a great job of scratching the surface with that in neuroendocrine tumors. So even though we've got a couple of approved targeted therapies and we're likely about to have another, I think that we've really focused on a couple of pathways. There are efforts to try to perfect those pathways. or figure out other drugs that kind of fit into that ecosystem and figure out if we can switch back and forth between them and have additional ways to keep things at bay. So cabozantinib, we expect to be approved based on its data. It'll be another nice tool to have. It's going to fit in like what we talked about with the other two drugs as far as its efficacy does. There have been some other studies. I'll just mention surufatinib again, which isn't currently being developed in the U.S. to my knowledge, unless something's happening I'm not aware of. But it's another example of how these drugs can work. There's other drugs like it that have been taken into a smattering of small trials, looking at additional VEGF therapies. Lenvatinib, I think, to me, was the most notable data as far as a VEGF-directed therapy that had a 44% response rate in pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors, but is stalled in its further development. So that was a phase 2 study, which means a little bit too small to draw conclusions for the whole populace. But anytime you see that 4 out of 10 individuals with a pancreatic neuroendocrine tumor are having what we call major shrinkage on a scan, that usually gets us to sit up and pay attention. So further perfecting those pathways is still of interest. I think that we look at neuroendocrine tumors, and a lot of times they don't have a ton of mutations to target. There aren't high percentages of it, but we're getting a lot better at doing things like looking at the human genomics in a way that's practical and cost-effective. I'll usually tell patients, you know, 15 years ago, it cost $3 billion and took 10 years to sequence the human genome. Now it costs about $3,000 and takes about 10 days. With that, we're getting a ton of information. We're finding out about all these fusions and other things that we didn't know were present in tumors, and there's drugs to target that. In neuroendocrine tumors, we're working with data that says maybe we're not identifying all these things. So as we start to unlock some of what the genetics of these tumors are, we may find some additional targets come down the way. And there are an occasional targeted therapy to some specific gene mutations. I won't get into exactly which ones because it's small percentages that are being looked at, and they do have neuroendocrine tumor cohorts as well. I think that that's been the big revolution as far as how we look at targeted therapy is let's really get into the genetics of the tumor. The revolution that hasn't chased that in my mind is let's really get into the genetics of the patient so we know how bad we're beating them up with drugs, but that's a whole different kettle of fish. You'll start to see more targeted therapies come out as that technology gets easier and more comprehensive.
Wow, that's really exciting. And looking back, you said at the very beginning, a lot has changed over the years. We've learned a lot. There's much more to learn. There's a lot of work being done. And we as patients and caregivers have a lot to look forward to. And as patients, the best advice you gave, do the best you can at the time. And we look forward to hearing more. Thank you for all that you're doing in this field to grow and to learn more, to offer these trials and more information clinically, taking care of patients and educating us so we can stay informed about this topic and others and neuroendocrine cancer as a whole as well. So thank you so much and look forward to talking to you again in the future.
Well, thanks so much for having me, and thanks to the neuroendocrine patient community. It's a pleasure to serve.
Thanks for listening to the LACNETS podcast. Go to our website, lacnets.org/podcast, for episode transcripts and resources. We want to thank our podcast supporters, Ipsen, ITM, Crinetics, Curium, and Boehringer Ingelheim. For more information about neuroendocrine cancer, go to www.lacnets.org. LACNETS depends on donations to bring you programs such as this podcast. Please consider making a donation at lacnets.org/donate.